The following is For Your Ears Only. Now in our 31st year on air, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
From Tiananmen to Occupy, a veteran of the 1989 uprising in Beijing considers the changes in China since then and the U.S. political ferment with which he's now involved.
Presidential ad wars, analyzing the media messages and ground games of the Obama and Romney campaigns.
Frustration in Egypt, massacre in Syria. A Middle East expert on the prospects for both nations and the implications for America.
Fighting for our fighters. A Wall Street veteran of the Iraq War urges more job and health support for others back from the front there and in Afghanistan.
Centennial songs. Cabaret star Maud Maggart celebrates the music that marked big changes 100 years ago, and you could actually hum along.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only. Now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For your ears only for the week of June 3rd and Britain's Diamond Jubilee, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson.
The noise of gunfire rose from all over the center of Peking. It was unremitting. On the streets leading down to the main road to Tiananmen Square, furious people stared in disbelief at the glow in the sky, listening to the sound of shots.
Sounds of protest in Beijing and New York City decades apart. This week marks the 23rd anniversary of the student-led uprising and bloody government repression in Tiananmen Square, as reported by the BBC on June 4, 1989. A year later on this show, we spoke with the leader of that uprising, by then exiled and studying in the United States. His name is Shen Tong, and as we learned from another guest on this show several weeks ago, he has now become involved with the Occupy Wall Street phenomenon that we just heard reasserting itself this past May Day.
In the years between, Shen Tong has become an actor, author, tech and media entrepreneur, and social activist. Now, some thoughts about the changes he's seen and those he expects in China and the U.S. We're pleased to have Shen Tong on the line again for your ears only. Welcome back to our program.
Thank you.
You've written about the emotional echoes of Tiananmen you felt at Zuccotti Park in New York, birthplace of Occupy. Talk about that.
Once in a while, a society is lucky enough to have a real transformative change from a grassroots social movement, and that's what I felt back in 89, and that's what I felt last fall in Zuccotti Park and in the global Occupy movement.
You also wrote that you arrived thinking your Tiananmen experience gave you something to teach the occupiers, but instead found yourself learning lessons from them about developing real democracy. Perhaps strangely for a refugee from communism, it was the importance of a communal spirit. Say more.
The Occupy movement was first and foremost a communal conversation. So it didn't take me long to realize that this is very different. Zuccotti Park wasn't Tiananmen Square. It was not a mass protest with a demand of the power that might be making certain changes. It's awakening and a civic revival of American general public. I mean, it's not only a phenomenon in America, but in America it was particularly significant, being a generally very apathetic country in the last 30, 40 years.
You make a point about that apathy as a kind of function of American individualism or the myth of American individualism. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, personally, the American individualism and the social, political, even cultural symbols associated with that was correctly understood or not, was a source of inspiration for the youth of China back in the 1980s. So it was rather surreal for me to be exiled from Tiananmen, coming here, and realize not long after my exile in the late 90s, especially, that that translated into this ultra individualism and also that the individual as a passive consumer. And news or information or commercial news, passive receiver and voter, not as a direct participant of democracy. And that's very much a source of the problem the American society is now is experiencing, especially money-corrupted politics.
You're very much involved in technology and media. I wonder if you see social media working to further unite or isolate us behind our screens, large and small.
What's interesting is both. There's so much sensory overload through all the screens that we either passively watch or proactively interact with. But there's a curious lack of civic participation in the public sphere. And in the private and the social sphere, in the sense of connecting with friends, the lack of person-to-person, real engaging conversation versus rather just consumption of just lots of information. It's also curious, if not problematic. I mean, I think what activists experienced in Egypt or in other social movement, if this is true back in 1989, is that technology was tremendously important to pass information, but equally important, if not more, is to person-to-person real good old connection between individuals. And that's also true for the dynamics of the movement itself. Occupy was extremely successful in changing the national conversation by quickly using the technology and social media and come to the same sentiment, if you will, about a list of grievances. That was a very accurate and straightforward, and that's why Occupy Wall Street was successful. The problem seems to be centered on Wall Street. But then in terms of developing a sustainable movement and, say, a national organization, which requires not just technology, but also person-to-person connection. That's where the movement is struggling now.
Let's turn to China. The blind activist Chinese lawyer Cheng Wangcheng, who recently escaped from house arrest to the U.S. Embassy, is now a student at New York University. And last week he gave a surprisingly optimistic prognosis for democracy in China. What's your reaction?
It's a part of our DNA to be optimistic as activists. So there is that. And to a large extent, it's true, because hope, as one of the most influential Chinese contemporary Chinese writer Lu Xun once wrote, that it's like a road in a wilderness. There's no road, but after some daring people keep walking into the wilderness, there will be one. So there is that. But also, I think there's a number of aspects, especially in recent years, that the social polarization in the Chinese society will certainly make any careful watcher of China wonder how the system could sustain itself.
Do you think Chen will be permitted to return, or does all the new communications technology today give him even more of a presence in China if he stays free in the U.S.?
Oh, that's hard to say. To be perfectly honest, I mean, my own experience in the last almost 24 years since my exile in mid-June 1989, it's a mixed one. The ability of keeping the voice of pro-democracy movement alive in the West certainly is a great help to sustain the dissident movement in China by being in exile and being able to do something here, but also being removed almost so completely in the public domain in China certainly is a hindrance to our effectiveness. And I think my colleague Chen and others experienced the same situation. But in my case, I managed to go back to China multiple times in the last two decades or so, and sometimes getting arrested, other times I was able to reconnect with people and also having some influence in my writing under a different name that's kind of allowed by the government. It's a more unique situation because most of the exiles are not able to return to China. It remains to be seen whether he is allowed to do that.
Shen Tong was a student leader in Tiananmen Square 23 years ago this week, now U.S. high-tech entrepreneur and social activist.
Quote from the news, love for Mangal Bagh. That's how a Pakistani frontier court document referred to ties between Dr. Shakil Afridi, a physician who helped the CIA hunt Osama bin Laden, and a local Islamist warlord. Several sources last week said it was that connection, not the bin Laden operation, for which Afridi was sentenced to 33 years in jail.
Next, harsh presidential ads and harsher economics for your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. I don't have to go any further than the mirror. That was former North Carolina Senator John Edwards admitting his many sins, but agreeing with the Greensboro jury that could not find him guilty of criminally misusing campaign funds to cover up adultery and an illegitimate child as he ran for president. Now this.
People want to know what I stand for. They can look at my record as governor.
Romney economics doesn't work. It didn't work in Massachusetts, and it's not going to work in Washington.
Well, I think that it's more likely that he wasn't born here. It's a very good issue for Mitt Romney.
After weeks taking heat for his years in private equity, making and breaking companies for multi-million dollar profits, Mitt Romney might well have expected to find his stint as governor of Massachusetts also under attack in an Obama campaign ad. But Romney had only himself to blame last week for the flack he took, hooking up with Donald Trump, who can't seem to avoid TV cameras or questioning Barack Obama's birthplace.
With Romney finally winning enough convention delegates to cinch the nomination, the carefully crafted campaign media war is clearly underway. But reality cannot be ignored, and the major political factors last week were a far worse than expected jobs report from the Labor Department and the dive it triggered on Wall Street. To consider these developments and more for your ears only, we're joined again by Princeton Professor of History and Public Affairs Julian Zelizer, whose books include Arsenal of Democracy, Jimmy Carter, and Governing America, new from Princeton University Press. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Was targeting Romney's state record a response to criticism of the vampire capitalism critique of Bain Capital from some fellow Democrats, including Bill Clinton? Or is it essential to questioning the value of Romney's business experience to governing?
Well, it's a pre-planned response, meaning the administration has always been planning to take Romney's record, which is what he's campaigning on, the fact he was good at business, the fact he was good at governor, and turning it against him. But I do think it was also a response to the fact that the initial launch of the Bain attack backfired, with many Democrats raising questions about whether that was the right approach, so they turned to Massachusetts.
What does history tell us about business leaders in government?
There's not much evidence that being in business makes you a good politician. You know, most of our leaders were governors, they were members of Congress, including some of the great ones. And a business record is something that's part of the portfolio of some presidents like George W. Bush. But really, there's absolutely little to make us think that doing good as someone who sells things, someone who runs things privately, will translate into working on Capitol Hill.
Especially, you can't sell off the America's poor people just because they're not adding to the bottom line. You also write that Obama has to be careful about Romney's record because he's heaped such praise on his health care reform in Massachusetts. But doesn't that just further raise doubts about Romney with the party's most conservative base?
Well, Romney doesn't have to worry about that so much right now, meaning he got through the primaries, and that's where the activists matter most. In the general election, most activists will care most about defeating President Obama rather than whether Romney is some kind of pure right-wing conservative, and the polls show that he's slowly winning support with the right wing. So I think right now those kinds of issues like the health care law become more problematic for Obama than they do for Romney.
What impact on the campaign do you see from the Tea Party pressures in Congress? There are threats of another debt ceiling crisis without more budget cuts or different cuts than the parties agreed on last time.
The biggest crisis is the perception of extremism beyond the actual policy issues. Romney is trying to run far away from the idea that Republicanism means right-wing Republicanism. He needs to win independent votes in these swing states. He wants to win the votes of disaffected Democrats. And so what happens in Congress could affect how people view Romney's party. So Romney needs to be careful. He needs to hope for John Boehner being able to control members of the House and avoiding some kind of showdown that gives credence to the argument that Republicans are extremists.
Did the Trump talk about Obama's birth again do more for Romney with the right than it hurt him with moderates and independents who don't think much about it at all anymore?
I don't think it's going to have a huge effect. I think, you know, Trump is kind of a sideshow at this point, and people like watching him, but it's almost like watching someone on television, which is now what he's become, the star of The Apprentice rather than a business person. So I don't think it really helps or hurts. I think this is about economics, and I think that's really where this election will be decided.
Do you think Obama's support on the left was further weakened by last week's stories in the New York Times about how he has taken a personal role in ordering drone strikes and other targeted assassinations of suspected terrorists around the world without court-tested evidence, but often with significant civilian injuries and deaths?
Well, I think it will continue to fuel some of the distrust or discomfort that many on the left have with the current president. That story was yet more news, yet more of a revelation that Obama has continued many of the policies of the Bush administration rather than rejected them. Some people think that the Obama team leaked that story, that they wanted that story out there so he appears as tough on defense, but it does create these fissures with the left wing.
Similarly, is Obama helped on both the left and right by the Times story on how he's personally and persistently authorized collaboration with Israel on computer viruses, Stuxnet and now Flame, both to cripple Iranian nuclear operations and stall a threatened Israeli strike on them?
I think all of these stories, at least the hope is for the White House, help him really not with the left, obviously, but more with independent and moderate voters. It's part of a package. It's part of an effort to resell this presidency, to counteract the claim from the right that this is a left-wing person in government, and to instead show that certainly on foreign policy, he is as hawkish as his predecessor, if not more, dealing with everything from cybersecurity in the Middle East to drone strikes and targeted assassinations.
To what degree do all of these factors pale against last week's grim employment news, sliding Wall Street, and increasing danger signals from the Eurozone?
They're small potatoes. I think the economic news that came out the last week was absolutely devastating to the administration. I think many officials are watching the stock market, they're watching the jobs numbers, and they don't know what to do. They realize that if this continues and the instability in Europe continues, Romney has his best arguments, and it totally neutralizes the administration's main strategy to use Romney's economic record against him, because everyone will be scratching their heads looking at what's happening nationally and ask Obama exactly what he has to offer that's better.
Do you see new actions by the administrations or the Federal Reserve?
Maybe. They're hoping Ben Bernanke puts some stimulus into this economy, but the tools are limited. And especially given what's happening in Europe, it's not clear Bernanke has the power to really get the economy moving. This might be the best we have. It might get a little better or not worse. But going into the next few months, that's not really what the president's hoping for.
Is there a deadline by which the economy has to move into a higher gear before Obama really loses any likelihood of reelection? Or can he still make it a choice and a question about whether Republicans can do any better?
That's how he's going to have to win. There's almost no economic data to show that the economy is going to get much better by September or October. So what he's hoping for is there's not another huge decline, in which case it's very likely he loses this election. And what he's going to have to do is not make an argument that things are good, not make an argument that it's morning in America again, but say of the two alternatives, I have the best strategy for the next 4 years. That's a very hard sell, but that's how he's going to have to win.
Princeton professor of history and public affairs Julian Zelizer. His books include Arsenal of Democracy, Jimmy Carter, and Governing America, new from Princeton University Press.
Quote from the news, "Thank you so much for inviting our rowdy friends to my hanging." That was former President George W. Bush to Barack Obama at the White House after former associates cheered the unveiling of his official portrait there.
Next, frustration in Egypt, massacre in Syria. For your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson with this quote from the news, an effort to put a thumb on the scales. That was Boston Federal Appeals Court Judge Michael Boudin ruling against part of the Defense of Marriage Act as denying equal protection of the law to gay couples and improperly influencing state marriage laws. Now this.
No candidate received the majority of the vote in order to win outright. So the runoff, according to the electoral law, will be between Dr. Mohamed Morsi and Dr. Ahmed Shafiq, because they were the two top winners.
We certainly agree with Kofi Annan that this is a moment where we have reached, in effect, a tipping point. There were massacres committed in close range of over 100 people. The vast majority have been women and children. Some killed by heavy weapons, the other killed, it seems, by every indication by the Shabia militias acting on behalf of the government.
In Egypt last week, despite the historic nature of its first relatively free and fair presidential election, turnout was a remarkably low 46%, and there was widespread frustration at the impending runoff between two polarizing opponents, Mohamed Morsi, chairman of the Muslim Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party, versus former Mubarak-era Prime Minister Ahmed Shafik. Mubarak himself was sentenced to life in prison for his role in the killing of Arab Spring peace protesters.
But the struggle of emerging democracy in Egypt was a model of manners compared with continuing government massacres and opposition violence in Syria, as described by Washington's ambassador to the United Nations, Susan Rice. And whether the mounting death toll there had really reached the tipping point Rice saw to prompt more muscular international intervention remains very much an open question. To consider the prospects for peaceful politics in both countries, for your ears only, we're joined by Middle East expert Michael Wahid Hanna, a fellow at the Century Foundation in New York. Welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start in Egypt. First, what impact from the Mubarak sentencing?
Well, I think the top line story will be the sentencing of the former president. But it was a very controversial decision, and it's going to have effects, ripple effects in terms of the presidential campaign. Mubarak wasn't found guilty of ordering the suppression and repression of the protests, but of not doing anything to stop them. And so there is still nobody responsible for ordering the deaths of protesters. And several of the key generals in the Ministry of Interior, who clearly would have had a hand in carrying out this plan, were declared innocent. And so we are going to see, I think, increased mobilization. There are people already filling up in Tahrir Square again. And so this has created quite a bit of anger. And obviously the Muslim Brotherhood and their presidential candidate, Mohamed Morsi, are going to try to tap into that anger to overcome some of the divisiveness that exists and try to garner some additional swing votes that might have simply stayed home.
Where does that Muslim Brotherhood candidate really stand on the spectrum of Islamist ideology and intentions for religious rule?
Some of it is speculation. We don't know what the Muslim Brotherhood will do because they've never been in power, per se. We do know that their sort of short period involved in politics since the fall of the former regime has been controversial and has been divisive. And they have often displayed a go-it-along streak. And so they haven't been a consensus-building organization in a time of political tumult. There are clearly others, like the Salafis, who are more rigid Islamist actors. So, we wouldn't want to describe them as the most extreme. But a lot of these are unanswered questions because they haven't actually had a chance to govern.
What happened to the secular spirit that so fueled the historic protests in Cairo's Tahrir Square? Or was it always destined to be overshadowed by the better organized Islamists and remnants of the old army-backed regime?
Part of it was a myth that grew up. I mean, what was interesting about the uprising was that it included broad swaths of Egyptian society from all walks of life. I think in the early days, there might have been disproportionate representation from the younger activist class. Part of the real tragedy in Egypt is that political fragmentation of many of these new political actors, I think, has privileged the Brotherhood and now the sort of remnants of the former regime. But none of that was foreordained. I mean, this is the function of various choices made by political actors and an inability, frankly, to coalesce around unified demands. But to some extent, obviously, those with organizational advantages were always going to have a leg up in this race.
Let's shift to Syria, where up to now you have seen little chance for Kofi Annan's Arab League UN diplomatic solution, but even less for consensus on international military action. If last weekend's massacre of 100 or more in the town of Hawla and more multiple killings in the days that followed are not enough, can anything break Russian and Chinese resistance to serious intervention?
Well, I mean, I think that's the question of the day, and I think it's more important to focus on Russia. I think China will follow along if it has cover at the Security Council from Russia. And so I think the ultimate question is Russia concerned about a specific strategic outcome in Syria? Can they be persuaded on the merits and on the substance of the case? Or are they more inclined to simply exercise their ability to veto, to say no, to project their influence on the global stage? I think it behooves all actors to try to exhaust that path. I don't think we are there yet. We might be getting very close, because a diplomatic solution, a managed transition, unlikely as it seems now, is the only near-term solution to this. If this option fails, if the Annan Initiative collapses, then we're looking at a protracted and prolonged civil war. There's a civil war now in Syria, but what we are looking at in the event of the failure of Kofi Annan, I think, is a multi-year and a very brutal sectarian conflict, and I think we should exhaust all possible other remedies before foreclosing that possibility.
And how great is the danger of it spreading beyond Syria's borders?
There's always that danger. With the Iraq War, we saw that conflict descend into sectarian civil war. There were some ripple effects in the region, but it wasn't massive spillover. So we shouldn't be exaggerating. But obviously, if we look at Lebanon, we do see some sectarian violence erupting that is clearly linked to Syria. The Iraqis are quite concerned. That is a porous border, and so there is concern about what that would do in terms of injecting destabilizing sectarian narratives back into Iraqi politics. So there is some concern, and I don't mean to diminish that, because we've already seen now in Lebanon that this is having cross-border effects.
Middle East expert Michael Wahid Hanna is a fellow at the Century Foundation in New York.
Quote from the news, "We became your customer today." That was NASA's manager for commercial spaceflight, Alan Lindenmoyer, promising regular supply missions and larger payloads to the SpaceX company after its Dragon capsule made the first ever private enterprise rendezvous and return from the International Space Station.
Next, Vets and Jobs, for your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. "On National Donut Day, be a patriot. Eat one for yourself, one for freedom." That was the headline of a press release from the Competitive Enterprise Institute protesting new food regulations like New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg's proposed restrictions on sugary soft drinks over 16 ounces. Quote, "This gives grasping at straws a whole new meaning," said Jeff Steyer of the National Center for Public Policy Research. Now this.
Nobody's more skilled, more precise, more diligent, more disciplined. Our veterans are some of the most highly trained, highly educated, highly skilled workers that we've got. These are Americans that every business should be competing to attract.
President Obama last week reasserted the pledge he made at an Arlington, Virginia fire station in February, and before that, in his State of the Union address, to help military veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan back on the job front at home. At a Honeywell plant in Golden Valley, Minnesota, the president called on Congress to quit stalling on his proposal for a Veterans Job Corps to get vets into police and fire departments and other civilian occupations.
The timing was tough, however, as both Wall Street and Main Street staggered under the Labor Department's latest bad news. Only 69,000 jobs created in May, less than half what analysts had forecast. It sent the unemployment rate back up to 8.2% and the Dow down 270 points for the day, 336 points for the week, its biggest decline since November.
Still, the case for helping vets help themselves and the economy is an important one. To consider it, for your ears only, we're pleased to welcome back Owen West, former Marine Corps Reserve Major in Iraq and author of a memoir of that experience, The Snake Eaters, from the Free Press, Simon & Schuster. Wes is also a 14-year veteran of Goldman Sachs, where he's now a managing director and deeply involved in the investment banking network called Veterans on Wall Street. Welcome back to our program.
Thanks for having me.
What's your reaction to the president's plan for a Veterans Job Corps, especially a new credentialing plan that would help vets get civilian certification and licensing for high-demanding skill sets they've already acquired?
Well, I think the president should be acknowledged for doing a terrific job on this front, and I think he's basically exactly right. I'm not sure about the details, but I do know that it's clear to all vets that whatever you think about the president's policy or strategy in Afghanistan, that he's really supporting them at home, and that goes for his wife as well.
As with the plan to keep student loan rates down, there seems little likelihood of bipartisan agreement on where the $1 billion to fund a Veterans Job Corps would come from. What's your view?
Yeah, you know, I'm not an economist. I will say that I actually think the onus on hiring veterans is left to individual citizens and corporations. We can take care of this problem. I mean, basically, both President Bush and President Obama have left it up to us to decide as individuals whether we should donate our time or money, and as corporations, you know, what we should do about hiring veterans. In my opinion, I think hiring veterans is just good business. I mean, that's how we see it on Wall Street, and that's what we're doing at Goldman Sachs and at banks on the street.
What are the particular advantage of vets or obligations to vets that you see, especially on Wall Street?
Well, today's military is the best educated force in our history. In my judgment, you know, I have looked at squad leaders with no college, but three tours on very complex battlefields, and check their decision-making and leadership against those in average liberal arts colleges where they have, you know, courses, as I took, piano music in the 19th century and other things that really don't apply to the business world. And I scratch my head and wonder, why is it that we still require college for many of these jobs? I think we really have to that's an antiquated model, and we have to basically accept that a veteran with many tours is the same as a college graduate.
You've written that at your firm, Wall Street giant Goldman Sachs, military spirit and standards are part of the DNA, going back to a veteran of the Normandy invasion of World War II. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Goldman's business principles were authored by John Whitehead, a former chairman who was involved in the landing at Normandy and at Iwo Jima. The fact is that on Wall Street, we've always had a really terrific relationship with veterans, and that each firm is chock full of vets. I just know that in terms of what a vet brings to the table in our business, many of the qualities are really invaluable, and they're exactly what we're searching for, especially discipline, fidelity, and the fact that veterans are basically reliable in the worst of circumstances, where others who have not been tested yet sometimes act strangely.
And you say that that sense of loyalty means less employment turnover and the need for retraining.
That's exactly right. You know, at our firm, veterans have the lowest turnover among any group that we track. And that's, I think, basically become because you come up believing that there's something bigger than yourself. So that in tough times, again, you wouldn't hop for more money necessarily. You might stay loyal to that firm to try to see the job through.
Talk about your Veterans on Wall Street network, how it works and how well it works in terms of jobs made available.
Veterans on Wall Street was started by groups of veterans and individual banks. And the nice thing is, you know, competition on Wall Street is typically ruthless. But in this case, we cooperate just to ensure that we maximize the jobs we're getting to vets. So if I don't have a spot for someone at Goldman Sachs, I just pass this resume along and really push for some of these folks to get them jobs. I think, you know, we're at the outset of a nationwide movement to help our vets. My dad served in Vietnam and was obviously welcomed much differently when he came back. So it's really nice to see that there's true bipartisanship on this issue, and it's apolitical. And I think that's basically right. I mean, the country should look out for its guardians. And I don't know what happened in the late 60s and 70s, but I am thankful for what's happening today.
In what other fields do you see real efforts being made to help vets and exploit their special abilities?
Well, the retail outlets, you know, obviously if you look at, this includes banks that have, you know, may have outlets in Omaha, Nebraska, or Tallahassee, Florida, et cetera. The same thing with retail stores. These folks have also launched a very serious effort to try to hire folks who are good when they're left alone and essentially in decentralized businesses, the same way that we fight a decentralized war today in Afghanistan, for example. So that you can put responsibility on a 23-year-old who served two tours as a machine gunner that you wouldn't normally put on a 23-year-old without that experience.
Owen West is a third-generation Marine and 14-year veteran of Goldman Sachs, where he's a managing director and works the Veterans on Wall Street Network. His new book is The Snake Eaters, from Simon & Schuster.
Quote from the news, there are a lot of people out there looking for any excuse not to exercise. That was Professor William Haskell at the Stanford Prevention Research Center on new findings that exercise may actually increase the risk of heart problems in up to 10% of those who do it.
And this, it's going to be a slow summer. That was James Krapfel of Morningstar Research on how the disappointing stock launch of Facebook, now down nearly 26%, is diminishing interest in other initial public offerings.
Next, songs from a century ago, for your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson.
I lost the sunshine and roses. I lost the heavens of blue. I lost the
Young cabaret star Maude Maggart has always had a way with and a voice for the old songs. That one is a century old this year, Irving Berlin's first ballad, When I Lost You. It marked the death of his first wife in the 1912 typhoid epidemic they encountered on a honeymoon in Cuba.
This week, Maggart brings a whole new show of more or less centennial songs and the stories that go with them to Feinstein's at the Loews Regency Hotel in New York through June 16th. And with a preview for Your Ears Only, we're pleased to have Maude on the line now. Welcome back to our show.
Thank you.
Your new show, Into the Garden, takes its title from an 1857 song with even older roots, and your name in it. Tell us that story.
Well, the story is that the song Come Into the Garden, Maude, is from a Tennyson poem written in 1850 called Maude. Very, very long poem and really dense. They're beautiful words, and this Irish composer took the poem, a part of the poem, and put the lyrics to music that he composed, and the effect of a really beautiful song. And so there's only really a 7-year gap in between the actual composition of the words and the composition of the music and putting the words into a song.
This new show was also motivated by all the recent attention to the Titanic tragedy 100 years ago.
Well, it started out being motivated that way because I didn't really know what I wanted to concentrate a show about, and I thought, okay, this is a big deal, the centennial of the Titanic. And also, the year 1912 I like a lot of songs from that era. So, wait a minute, I think there's something there. So the Titanic was an initial inspiration, but I really don't talk about the Titanic or anything in the show. But it is, it did provide a seed for me to water and put soil in and try to grow into the little flower of a show.
The Titanic tale also led you to songs written or sung by notables who made those Atlantic crossings and cross-pollinated the British and American songbooks, Cole Porter, Noel Coward. Talk about that.
Well, of course, Cole Porter wasn't from Britain. We all know that. But yeah, he definitely was part of the Noel Coward kind of set that seemed more educated and kind of brought in a little bit more poetry, I guess, just in terms of what people thought was, I think, fancy in Tin Pan Alley, which was still, happening at the time.
And what Coward and Porter songs do you sing?
I just do one Cole Porter number, Experiment, and it's from 1933. But the idea behind Experiment is that for anybody to change anything, they have to experiment.
Some songs on your list I never even heard of. The Society Bear.
Irving Berlin from 1912, right?
Take Me to the Cabaret.
Yeah, well, that Society Bear is in the song Take Me to the Cabaret. Do you know the song Take Me to the Cabaret?
No.
Take Me to the Cabaret basically is a tune about a tune, and I kind of think about it as like an early... it's a precursor to all of the, hip-hop songs that sample other hit songs.
Oh, wow.
Because inside Take Me to the Cabaret, it's basically like, take me to the cabaret where I can sing this hit song, So it basically is using the success of other songs to make a hit out of itself. That's why I say it's kind of a precursor to hip-hop songs that sample.
There's another I wanted to ask you about, Get Off the Track from 1844 and the Hutchinson Family Singers associated with it.
Well, Get Off the Track, Yeah, it was written in 1844, and it was taken from, it's a very interesting parody, because that's what it really was. It was a parody of the song Old Dan Tucker. Old Dan Tucker was a fine old man, washed his face in a frying pan, combed his hair with a wagon wheel, and died with a toothpick in his heel. You know, I mean, pretty furious, pretty silly lyrics about a man who basically overate, overdrank, and was good for nobody, you know. And the Hutchinson family singers took this tune, which actually wasn't written in 1843. It was, you know, a much older song, but I think the first sheet music was published in 1843. And what this family of singers did was to interpolate this tune into a much deeper meaning. So Hutchinson family singers were reform singers. They were the earliest reform folk singers.
By reform,
they wrote this song "Get Off the Track" about emancipation, and they became some of the biggest proponents for abolition. And I find them fascinating. I mean, their tunes aren't, because they're arranged for a vocal quartet. They're not really appropriate for me to perform, but their story is really fascinating. And the fact that they were so brave and important in a way that is really forgotten today in terms of popular music. I mean, what they did with the popular song, turning it into a parody about emancipation. You know, it's really fascinating stuff for me, who's so interested in popular songs.
Maud Maggart brings Into the Garden into Feinstein's at the Loews Regency Hotel in New York this week through June 16th.
I lost the gladness, it turned into sadness when I lost you.
And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only On Air is online at iTunes, YouTube, and feedburner.com. But to continue, we really need your tax-deductible donation. Please email me at davidearsonly@gmail.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Daly at The Hangar Studio with intern Amy Snopek. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern. Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts with support from gatewave.org, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, and award-winning ACAM Associates, Exceptional Management, Impeccable Reputation, for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Amy Snopek. This week, last year, we spoke with a veteran of the Vietnam War about its lessons for the conflicts of today in Iraq, Afghanistan, and beyond, from our June 5th, 2011 broadcast hosted by David and Melissa Exelberth.
I was following the governor when he called me and said, "Come faster." And when he called, suddenly a big explosion happened. We don't know how it happened and who did it. We lost our vision.
Taliban forces in Afghanistan last week battled British troops and staged a suicide attack that killed an Afghan security chief, as one survivor recounted for Al Jazeera English. And NATO forces prepared for escalating violence in another summer offensive, encouraged now by plans for the start of an Allied drawdown. The deaths of 110 coalition troops in April and May were already a record for those 2 months in almost 10 years of war with Islamist extremists.
In Iraq, too, roadside bombings and suicide attacks continued as internal rivalries followed the withdrawal of most U.S. troops, dramatizing the complex mix of motivations that fuel violence and terrorism in the region. Understanding the mind of our enemy has never been more important, says retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel James G. Zumwalt, a Vietnam and Gulf War veteran whose family has served in every conflict since the American Revolution. Tragically, his brother died of cancer linked to the Agent Orange defoliant sprayed in Vietnam on orders of their father, Vice Admiral Elmo Zumwalt, youngest ever chief of naval operations.
Initially, James Zumwalt's reaction was anger at the Vietnamese enemy, but he subsequently became sensitive to the losses suffered by the Vietnamese as well, and to the psychology that had driven them so successfully in the first war America could not be said to have won. His book about it is Bare Feet, Iron Will, Stories from the Other Side of Vietnam's Battlefields from Fortis Publishers. And to discuss its lessons for current conflicts, for your ears only, we're pleased to have James Zumwalt on the line now. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
It was traveling to post-war Vietnam with your late father about the Agent Orange problems that led to your change of heart on your former enemies there, specifically talking with a Vietnamese general who also lost a brother. Tell us how that affected you.
I had been talking to the general in a one-on-one conversation about the war and its impact, and when he shared that with me, it was kind of like a light went on. I asked myself, was the loss of a loved one any less significant just because it occurred on the other side of the battlefield? And the answer was obviously no. This was something that was devastating to both of us.
You ended up making 50 return visits. What kind of people did you interview?
Mostly veterans involved in all aspects of the war, pilots, communication personnel, members of both the North Vietnamese Army and the Viet Cong forces. Also, many civilians, mothers who had lost several sons in the conflict.
And what did you learn about the Vietnamese psychology that you wish you and other Americans had known before we escalated our military involvement there?
The one thing that really became crystal clear to me was their creativity and ingenuity. They basically had a skill at causing us not to see things on the battlefield that were there and to see things there that weren't. In the first category, We knew where parts of the Ho Chi Minh Trail were, but we did not know where all the legs of the trail were. So we would look at rivers because we knew they had to be crossing rivers at points. They knew we knew this, and so they would build bridges for the sole purpose of us having a target to attack. Unbeknownst to us, either several miles up or downstream from that bridge, they had a system of what they called submarine bridges. And a submarine bridge was a bridge platform that was built about a foot and a half under the low water mark. And for those people who are familiar with the waterways in Vietnam, it's called brown water for a reason. You can't see anything under the surface. And an example of things they caused us to see that were there that weren't, the Cu Chi Tunnels was an extensive tunnel network in the southern part of Vietnam, about 30 miles outside of Saigon. It was a network of tunnels about 320 kilometers. They, digging this massive tunnel system, they had a problem with what to do with all the extra dirt. Where possible, they would scatter it in the jungle. If there was a B-52 crater, they would fill a B-52 crater with the excess dirt. But there were times, too, when they just had piles of dirt, and so they had some of their more artistic soldiers take this dirt and actually make termite mounds out of it. So from the air, you would see numerous termite mounds, but you wouldn't, it didn't look like anything unnatural, so we just passed it over.
How do you compare the psychology of the Vietnamese fighting forces with that of the Islamist enemy we face today?
I'd say it's very different. In interviewing the hundreds of Vietnamese veterans that I interviewed, it was clear that their motivation was not too different than ours. They wanted to fight the war, they wanted to win, they wanted to survive, and they wanted to return to their loved ones and pursue a livelihood. That's exactly what we wanted to do. Comparing that to the enemy we're fighting today, he doesn't necessarily have a desire to survive on the battlefield because he sees death as a vehicle by which he will go to the afterlife and reap his rewards. I think another difference, too, is when we lost the war in Vietnam, we weren't worried about the Vietnamese following us home. If we lose the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, that is a very real problem.
Do you distinguish between a group like the Afghan Taliban, mostly wanting to control their own country, and al-Qaeda groups with a larger anti-Western terrorist agenda?
There's a common link. Both of them look to employ or apply strict Sharia law. I think the big difference is that the Taliban looks to do it on a domestic basis. Al-Qaeda looks to do it on an international basis.
How do you see the threat of Al-Qaeda and its offshoots around the world since the elimination of Osama bin Laden, also a high-ranking deputy, by drone strike in Pakistan last week?
Well, Al-Qaeda in 2001 was fairly centralized with very extensive financial and communication networks in place. One thing that has happened by the time of Osama bin Laden's death is the fact that we had disrupted this pretty extensively. The bad news is, however, is there are a lot of franchise operations, mom-and-pop operations in place now that require a lot more resources to be able to monitor all these things that are going on.
Where do you stand on the question of aiding the dissident groups throughout the Middle East and North Africa? Some say that will open paths to power for more extremist groups like Al-Qaeda, the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, I think one important thing is to know who it is you're supporting. The thing that concerns me about, for example, Libya, is we don't know the distance. We really don't know whether they are going to be of the strict Sharia mindset or whether they are going to be more open-minded. I think we should not have gotten involved in Libya until we were able to make a clear determination on that. On the other hand, you take a look at Syria. That's a place where you have Assad, the president of Syria, who's basically in bed with Ahmadinejad of Iran. He could not be doing anything more to pursue interests contrary to those of the U.S., and I think that's where we should have gotten involved.
Retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel James Zumwalt is now a private security consultant and a member of the nonpartisan Committee on the Present Danger. His book is Bare Feet, Iron Will, Stories from the Other Side of Vietnam's Battlefields, from Fortis Publishers.
Know Thine Enemy, from our June 5th, 2011 broadcast. The United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan last week reported that civilian casualties had dropped 21% over the previous 4 months, but remained at, quote, unacceptably high levels. Underscoring the point, a suicide bomber blew up his vehicle outside a district police station in southern Afghanistan, killing 5 officers. And Taliban-linked attacks killed 13 people elsewhere around the country in a single day. In central Iraq, shootings and bombs killed 4, including a police colonel. Across Baghdad, bombings killed 17 on one day, and the next saw a roadside bombing on the outskirts that left 1 dead and 3 wounded. On the economic front, a landmark auction for gas and oil exploration drew far fewer sales than expected because of hard contract terms and inadequate infrastructure. I'm Amy Snopek. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now Maud Maggart with another song from a century ago, Irving Berlin's first big hit, a 1911 anthem for the ragtime era.
Oh my honey, better hurry and let's meander. Ain't you going to the leader man, ragged meter man, oh my honey. Oh, my honey, let me take you to Alexander's grandstand brass band. Ain't you coming along? Come on in here, come on in here. Alexander's ragtime band. Come on in here, come on in here. It's the best band in the land. They can play a bugle call like you never heard before. So natural that you wanna go to war. That's just the bestest band. What am honey lamb? Come on along, come on along. Let me take you by the hand. Up to the man, up to the man, who's the leader of the band. And if you care to hear that Swanee River played in ragtime, come on in here, come on in here, Alexander's ragtime band. Oh my honey, oh my honey, there's a fiddle with notes that screeches like a chicken, and the clarinet is a colored pick. Come and listen to a classical band. What's peaches come now somehow? Better hurry along. Come on in here, come on in here. Alexander's ragtime band. Come on in here, come on in here. It's the best band in the land. They can play a bugle call like you never heard before. So natural that you wanna go to war. That's just the bestest band. What